Hey everyone, so welcome to another episode of Cloud Conversations. I'm Rue Campbell, Security MVP, and today I'm delighted to be joined by the guys who've just finished writing, which I believe is going to be released either today or tomorrow, depending on when you're watching this, Microsoft Defend for Endpoint in depth on PAC Publishing. So we're joined by Justin Paul, whose second name I won't try and pronounce, and Joe. So do you guys want to introduce yourselves to our viewers?
Yeah, Justin can go first.
Yeah, I can go first. I'm Justin. I am a senior security engineer. I've been with Microsoft for about 5.5 years. I support our internal corporate security operations, or part of the team that does. I've been in IT for about 13 years. I got involved with the book. I think Paul and Joe already had an idea. I actually reached out to Joe to congratulate him on his first book, which was exam reference guide for SC200. And he said, hey, I've got this idea for a book on MDE. And I said, man, I'd love to be a part of that. I think what I brought to the table with the book was, you know, you'll get their introductions too, but, you know, Paul's got this deep technical kind of product engineering perspective. And, you know, Joe's on the Dart team and deals with these, what's likely a rarity for a lot of customers, which is this, you know, post-compromise, like fast-paced scenario. And I'm kind of the everyday user. So, you know, I use the tool every day. We work closely with the product group, but we have, you know, features that are private preview even sometimes, some features that never even see the light of day. Microsoft's big on what we call eating our own dog food. So we dog food a lot of features and give a lot of feedback to the product group, but I deal with the slow days too, right? So that's what's different for me is just that like normal security operations aspect of things for the, you know, within the bounds of Microsoft's enterprise network. So.
Neat, awesome.
Joe Anich, senior consultant for Microsoft on our detection and response team. My experience with MDE is really just, you know, it's one of the tools that we deploy in every engagement, most of them anyway. We use it for a multitude of reasons, which I'm sure we'll get into eventually. But yeah, 15 years in the industry, anything from device management to endpoint security, and then ultimately incident response the last couple of years.
All right. So it's Paul, program manager on the Defend for Endpoint team. Focus mostly on data center solutions, servers, Linux. Got in touch with Joe early on when we were building the unified agent for 2012 or 2016, when Joe reached out and said, hey, I'm with this customer. They desperately need the product that you're working on. Can we please deploy this? And so we started collaborating, and I very quickly realized that the scenarios that Joe was in, as recovery and incident response expert were like the best way to battle test the product. He would rapidly deploy. We would figure out how easy that was. We'd make adjustments, and then he would actually figure out, oh, you know, guess what? The machines that we installed the unified agent on, they didn't get compromised as a result of that rapid action. And that was kind of foundation for our working relationship between Dart and PG, and continued on like that. And he kept asking me questions about MDE. How does this work? How does that work? How does that work? And I was always answering, and he was like, dude, you know a lot about MDE. We should write a book. And I'm like, okay, that sounds like a cool idea. Kind of famous last words, because man, take a lot of effort. And he pulled in Justin, and I was like, wow, that's actually such a nice trio that we formed when we have someone with a deep product knowledge. You know, bringing that to the table and being able to explain that is kind of part of my job. And then Justin really hands-on operating this stuff when it's already deployed, and then Joe deploying this stuff in the worst of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And so then with our combined backgrounds and experience today, and I've personally also been in IT for quite a while, working at system integrators before I joined Microsoft about 6 years ago.
He's not going to age himself.
Yeah, I'm not going to. Let's not talk about that. This was just ideal. I think we couldn't have had a better team working on this book. And I think it shows. We had a lot of opportunity in front of us to really dive deep on certain areas, get some of the background that nobody's ever heard of, except for the people that worked here for like 20 years. And so excited to be here and be able to talk about the book and shed some light on the process and the people.
Awesome, definitely. Okay, so let's start diving into it then. I guess the first thing is let's focus on the book and what brought it about. So Joe, you were the instigator of all this trouble. Mm-hmm. What was it kind of, what motivated you into writing MDE in depth?
Yeah, well, like Paul said, you know, when we first started talking about the problem at hand, which was down-level servers, the relationship from there just kind of took off, and we were talking all the time about, you know, why does our documentation not have this? Why does our documentation not have that? I'm constantly running into this. I'm constantly running into that. The customers are making the same mistakes. You know, we need to have better documentation. It really just got to the point where there needed to be a longer format piece of documentation. Like the public docs are great. Kudos to everybody that works on them. There's just a lot more to it, to some situations and scenarios that the documentation's, I mean, we can't write everything in the documentation. We can't have hundreds of pages of public docs. That's not necessarily the goal of our public documentation. It's to get people started. It's to get them to understand kind of some of the high level items. And I was like, you know what? We need to go deep on this. We need to go as deep as we can and shed light on all of these other things that the docs don't necessarily go into. Some items were very high level. And we had the interest, you know, I had the interest. I had been wanting to do something like that for a while. I had actually kind of written a MDE course internally, like a level 400 course. That's of course still on my plate to get done. And I thought it would be more valuable to just go with the book instead and kind of lay the foundation for that. And, you know, with his knowledge, and we got Justin in the mix, and like he said before, we've kind of got MDE surrounded from just about every angle in terms of operating, deploying, engineering. So, we just pitched the idea to each other and said, let's go. Severely underestimating how much work it was. The first book that I did, PACT basically gave us the outline, you know, here's the exam outline. You know, fill in all of the sections. And so on this one, we had to basically come up with that all by ourselves, which we changed, I don't know, 40 times in the first couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Changing chapter names, section names. It was a blast, but.
Yeah. Apologies if we missed one, but a lot of time was actually spent rewriting the references to other chapters in the chapters. And even the editors missed some because we had changed so much. Like, it was very hard to get that right. But yeah, Joe's point around documentation, as a PM, I personally, you know, especially when I was doing the server stuff, I committed so many pieces of content to the documentation at the time. In the full realization, it's not enough. If you're not familiar with MDE, you need to know MDE to understand MDE, right? You need to know what you're looking for in those documentation in order to actually find the entry point and follow the documentation. And so if you don't already know MDE, then the documentation is not necessarily very accessible. And so it's indeed this longer format, finding the right entry point. If you're familiar with MDE, it's probably highly doable, and there's great content out there, and you can find whatever you need at the time. If you're not familiar with MDE, where do you start? And so that was kind of the mentality that we applied towards the book and said, hey, how do we create that entry point, and then how do we structure the book so that it makes sense. How do we pull the reader in and find some way to educate them from zero to 300 all in the course of one book? I don't know if we succeeded, but that was kind of the daunting task in front of us that we really wanted to go. Hey, you want to be successful with MDE? Guess what? Do all of this, know all of this, get hands-on with all of this, and then you can do this, which is kind of culminating into the SecOps that Justin brought to the table.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, the interesting thing that we found as we built it out was that there were so many audiences, right? There was the IT administrator audience, the security operations audience, and you can't put all of that in one doc or one book. And so, you know, it's a lot of boiling down documentation into something more consumable, sharing what insider info we had, really, you know, clear practical examples. But yeah, we ran from like, here's where it, the birth of MDE all the way through to, you know, here's how you use it every day as a security operations analyst. And your reader is not going to be all of those things, right? They're not going to be both the SecOps person and the person who implements it necessarily, unless it's a small org, right? But we thought it was great because it gives those people who don't do that as their day job, it gives them some perspective on the people that they work with, the people that they're partnering with to make MDE a successful tool in their environment, how they do their day job, right? Or at least what questions to ask to figure out how it's different than how we framed it, right? So.
Yeah, I think it'll be, for some folks, a good read from cover to cover. I think for others, it'll be a good reference book. You know, you bookmark certain sections, come back to them. I think the book will cover different needs for different people, for sure.
It's going to be a cover to cover one for me. That's a, that's no doubt about that. And I guess, so you mentioned an interesting point there about how really the book might be targeted to multiple audiences, right? Because when I'm deploying Defender for Endpoint, depending on the scale of the customer, I'm working with end user compute teams who are managing just the Windows and the apps that go on that Windows. I'm working with information protection teams because of the integration with Purview DLP, right? So you're working with a whole bunch of different folks. And even when you're describing how is Defender for Endpoint deployed and onboarded, you know, it's quite unique compared to some of its competitors insofar as you have the kind of the next generation protection engine, and then you have the EDR, and they operate together, but side by side and separately. And so on that thought process, when you were writing the book, what were some of maybe the, I don't want to say myths, but what are some of like common misunderstandings or things that you just really want folks to understand that maybe have been misunderstood about Defender for Endpoint?
Yeah, I'll take that. That's kind of on the daily, top of mind for me as a PM. I view the product as a whole. Even though we have a history, which is also in the book, of these separate paths of an antivirus or anti-malware solution that evolved significantly over the years. And then this fairly newer, if you will, solution that is more in the detection response space. At the end of the day, what it comes down to, you need all of them to have successful protection on an endpoint. Endpoint protection needs to cover the whole spectrum of prevention, detection, response capabilities. And the common misconception that I see is that you only need one or the other, or that if you're using a third-party anti-malware component that you have full fidelity in Defender for Endpoint, which you simply don't. Yes, it's modular. Yes, you can use them separately. Yes, you could have a situation where you're running your long-standing anti-malware solution on the box, but that should really just be a temporary solution. Like, that's from a migration perspective at best. And so we do our best to, from the product group, to make those experiences seamless and make sure that we have the best anti-malware and the best EDR. So we're best of breed and best of suite at the same time. And then flowing into that XDR narrative. And so that's one of the biggest misconceptions. what I really hope is that based on the earlier chapters, including the history on how these products actually evolve together and separately, it sheds some light on the similarities and why it is important to consider them together. Why in both products or both sides of the product, we leverage cloud heavily and how that works to your advantage. And then also some of the unique aspects of the anti-malware piece that people simply don't know about. Defender AV is often seen as a commodity. It's something, hey, it's on your consumer box. It must be very basic, but that's very, very far from the truth. So I definitely seized on the opportunity to elaborate on that in the book and to interweave the story. And to your point about different teams and different tools and different configurations, we try to be as agnostic to that as possible so that you can, with your own understanding of your own IT environment, come to some form of a conclusion of what suits you best and the pros and cons of that without being prescriptive as to what to exactly use. We give tips, we give guidance, but we never go like, you should really use this. Just weigh the pros and cons yourself, formulate a plan, go out and deploy. And that's how the book is structured. It's like we educate you, then we show you the way, and then we tell you how to use it.
Yep.
Yeah, I think some of the misunderstood things that I see from my perspective are things that I have to cover quickly. When we're deploying, you know, with third-party products, you know, oftentimes we're coming into environments with third-party products and, you know, trying to get them to understand the use cases that, you know, Dart is deploying for versus what the product can actually do. It's just the inter-component relationship that I think is misunderstood the most in terms of like what's actually doing blocking versus what's not doing blocking, the different modes things need to be in. You know, like one of the main misconceptions I think I see is that Sense, the EDR component, is what's doing blocking. It's really not. It's, you know, it's leveraging the AV side of things. So just basic things like that. And, you know, I think, you know, one of the things we try to do is certainly in chapter two and in chapter four, maybe, is talk about the components themselves. I don't think that we did, I don't think our documentation really goes over the components themselves, right? Everything is very high level. Everything is, you know, kind of broadly grouped in terminology, when realistically some of those terms are made up of, you know, four, five, six components. And so we really tried to break down those components as well, so people can really understand what's under the covers and what's doing what, what's responsible. When you see this service, it's likely around this activity. When you see this service, it's around that activity. So we're really trying to provide as much clarity as we can and really show people how robust the stack is in terms of components and the relationships among them.
Yeah, I'd agree with Joe on the component side of things and kind of what parts of, like you alluded to, Rue, you know, it's a lot of almost disparate products have been pushed together in a really nice way to give you this holistic, you know, security stack. And I think, you know, understanding what's doing what between EDR and AV and how those things work when you're going through a timeline in a case or something like that, and you see these events happening, knowing at what level it happened, knowing, you know, like the difference between prevented and blocked, right? What level of execution happened and what that actually means and what your response should be to that. I think a lot of that clarity comes from really understanding those things. And so I think the biggest misconceptions that I see on the ops side is people just interpret things based on verbiage. But working with the Defender folks for clarity, even in research for the book and then also just at work, you know, they put a lot of effort into the verbiage that's used within the portal for whether it was prevented or blocked. And I think when you think about it, it always makes sense, but it's still nice to have that clarification, you know, that if you see this verbiage, it means this exactly, right? Because then you can make decisions based on that.
Right. Yeah. No, I really want to dive into that one then, because so if we're speaking of it specific verbiage, and I couldn't have told you this off the top of my head, for example, if I'm in Defender for endpoint and I get an alert or an incident, is there a distinction between prevented and blocked? Because in my mind, I'm just kind of thinking those sound like the exact same thing. So is that the kind of thing that you would cover in the book then to say, hey, operationally, here's what these mean?
Yeah. And I don't want to try and speak to it here completely because I'd probably misspeak. But what I can say, like, that I remember offhand is that, and we absolutely do cover it in depth in the book, but like, prevented is your highest confidence that you're fine, right? Prevented means nothing. It wasn't allowed to execute. Nothing happened, right? But blocked means that it started executing and then it was stopped. And so there's potential there that something happened before the block happened. And so you do need to do a little more triage just to make sure that you're, you know, you're satisfied that the threat's been mitigated. Now the block happens quickly, right? So I don't want to get in the weeds and say, you know, that means there's something to be concerned about, but there is a difference there. And there are times in certain cases where that nuance is super important for making a call, right? Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And to the point, I guess, all of you made about the fact about how all these, it's like all these components that work together. When I'm doing workshops about Defend for Endpoint, you know, you invariably start by talking about 365 Defender, the XDR, and you say that is a stack of stuff. Then you start talking about Defend for Endpoint, and then you say that's a stack of stuff under the bigger stack of stuff. And then you start talking about something like, you know, Defender device control, and that's a stack of stuff under the stack of stuff that's in the big stack of stuff. You know, you've just got so many components that they're all just kind of playing nice with each other to give you that overall protection. And I guess so one of the examples that comes to mind is something like Block at First Sight. And the documentation for Block at First Sight is actually really good. It's very simple. It says, hey, turn on these three settings and you're good to go. But you could count in one hand the number of customers that really understand it, you know, and that really have gone in there and set up, and they understand the different cloud blocking levels. So I guess as far as that kind of recommendations for deployment architecture, you know, what are good settings? Is that the kind of advice that you offer in the book as well?
Yeah. I mean, as far as we could, a lot of it is, and especially the example that you give, a lot of it is very conditional on a customer's appetite for disruption versus protection, right? And so that is why also it's often hard to convey, especially when you talk about block and first sight and cloud protection, there is such an enormous amount of logic behind there that we cannot comprehend. You have to actually understand the full scope of the cloud services. You'd have to be a data scientist to make sense of what would the outcome be for my scenario. Like if I were to enable this in my environment, I'd have to take all the inputs and weigh them against my understanding of how the ML models work to predict for just one file what's going to happen. And so that is where we try to, as far as we could, just demystify it and say, all right, block at first sight, what is it for? Well, it's to prevent patient zero. And why is that? Well, there's a lot of net new malware out there, and we're pretty good at blocking that, but sometimes it slips through. Sometimes that's okay. Like if you take a little bit of a less risk-averse approach, you might actually find that even if something is allowed to execute, we still have an opportunity to save you from it, which is the block instead of the prevent. Right? And then block at first sight by itself is a fairly aggressive tool to use with. And then that's kind of where we can't make that decision for you, but we can sure give you a recommendation, right? And so that we tried to take that agnostic approach because at the end of the day, the product does a fairly good job at least when it comes to anti-malware. The base configuration is actually solid. And then it really becomes about, am I an enterprise and what kind of endpoint are we looking at? Is this, you know, one of those free roaming BYOD type or CYOD and you have a lot of freedom? Or are you a researcher in a nuclear facility type scenario? I mean, we can't describe all the scenarios in the recommended setting. So that's definitely something that we try to guide the reader towards making the right decisions for their specific circumstances.
Yeah, I know I was in talks with some of the folks in that area about maybe adding some different parts to the documentation in terms of here's what's needed setting-wise to actually enable it. here are the settings that are more about tuning it. And like he said, what's your appetite there? Which there are definitely things to consider in terms of, you know, maybe like the maturity of your security team in terms of being able to triage alerts and understand, you know, really like what Justin does, you know, diving into the alert itself, understanding, okay, if we tune this to be a little bit more aggressive, you know, we're probably going to have a better chance of grabbing, like Paul said, some of the patient zero things, the zero day stuff, but your appetite for false positives can also go up the more aggressive you get. So it's being able to have the maturity to understand, okay, if we're going to have a segment of our machines in our environment that are sensitive to us, if we want to be a little bit more aggressive, maybe, then we need to be able to understand the alerts that come in and dive deep into those to kind of weed out the false positives. So it's really whatever your appetite is.
Yeah.
As long as you understand, you know, the settings that are really meant for tuning, like the extended timeout, you know, the 50 seconds was really kind of what Microsoft determined to be the most beneficial to get the most value out of the block at first sight. If we give it 50 seconds, that tolerance seems to be the best for letting it do what it needs to do in the cloud block level. You know, it's set at high, seemed to be, again, the most beneficial in terms of a baseline. So,
yeah, I would agree.
No,
I think
it's a good point. And it almost becomes like a... Oh, on you go, Justin. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I just got to piggyback off that. I think it sounded like from Paul and Joe, I think they're great points. It almost sounded like we didn't give any recommendations, right? We just left it kind of general. And that's not the case. Like, we gave recommendations in a lot of circumstances, and we tried to expand all these scenarios as much as we could, right? If this is you, then maybe this is your best option. But yeah, we just tried to feed the information. But there are cases like automated investigation response, AIR, where you know, the recommendation hands down is turn it on, right, fully. And that's Microsoft and us, and there's just a lot of confidence in how that works, and there's so much, you know, trillions of, you know, events of telemetry that are feeding that. And so we wanted to pay that forward too, right? Where when we know that you should have confidence, and maybe that's not as clear as it could be in the documentation, that, you know, just run with this, we threw that out there too. Like, you can go. This is safe, run with it. So
right. Yeah, that's good. Because I guess there will be stuff that just kind of, you look at it and you're like, that's kind of no-brainer stuff, right? I mean, EDR and block mode to some extent kind of falls into that park as well for me anyway. And I guess it's also, it becomes a bit of a customer maturity model, right? And so far as, yep. I guess, maybe keep me honest here, Joel, but maybe the folks in the scenarios you'll be working with, it's kind of like, look, just get Defender for out there. Just push it out. We're in incident response mode. We just need to get this stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
But then maybe you've got the customer who isn't dealing with an incident and they're just going through their normal architecture and deployment. Okay, well, your maturity model might be start with standard block at first sight, put it to normal, and then wait a second. Then maybe for your privileged access workstations, maybe put it to high plus or zero tolerance and just kind of gradually turn that big dial, right, so that you're, you know, you don't have to bite all this stuff off at once, I guess, is the point, right?
Yeah, those are definitely, certainly in the situations that I find myself in, those detailed conversations are more secondary. Like, one of the biggest reasons we need to get MD out there is for one, visibility for our analysts. There are some supplemental things that it does, you know, like being able to deploy some forensic tooling through MDE, through live response, and getting those capabilities. But yeah, depending on the customer, if the maturity isn't there, it's mostly, let's get this out there. Let's get them protected, whether there's third party or not. There's a multitude of benefits for it. It's visibility for us, the ability to deliver additional tooling. And then there's kind of delivering that, you know, elite level of protection that they may or may not have had prior. So yeah, it really depends. Certainly when we talk to customers that are, you know, sometimes they're full Microsoft shops, the full stack, and it's just about kind of fine tuning from there and leveraging where they're at, you know, meeting them where they're at. And then it's there's other products and just making sure they understand that when we roll this out, if they have expectations that it's going to be doing all of the blocking and all of the this and that, it's kind of making sure that that they understand all of the finer details in terms of, you know, if you have these products in there, They're the ones that are going to be the active AV. Our AV is going to be a passive, which allows you these features, you know, just kind of setting expectations. But it kind of depends on how big the fire is and, and what's on fire. But yeah, we certainly have all of those conversations.
When through both Dart and through Microsoft internal security, when you're working with the product so much, you must gather like a bunch of ideas and feedback from both internal and from customers and stuff. And then obviously, you know, the Twitterati and the customer connection program, they're not exactly quiet about what they think about stuff either. How, and maybe this is a question for yourself, Paul, how do you then take all that feedback, filter out the good ideas from the bad ideas, but then deliver it in a way that, well, you know, if I'm just thinking out loud here, MDE is on a ton of stuff, right? So you've got to kind of do it in a way that is manageable. What's the kind of process then for figuring out, well, what direction does the product head in?
There's, first and foremost, there are indeed just a whole lot of channels through which feedback actually gets funneled towards us. And I mean, there's no time to kind of describe them all, but on a high level, I mean, a lot of the feedback is kind of more of a confirmation of what we already knew, and that we were planning for. And so that it just serves as extra evidence, and we take that as extra evidence. So, you know, plus one, plus two, and we keep track of that. We also have long-standing partners. We have customers that we work with directly as the product group that have proven to be great partners when it comes to early previews and feedback about existing products. We have a lot of teams out there that are at customer sites every day. As you say, there's the customer connection program, which is also inclusive of our MVP community, which is a very valuable asset to us. And so as a PM, what we try to do, we have our own focus areas, and that's kind of how we try to cut through the noise, is that we redirect these funnels so we can categorize and streamline and make sure that we bucketize the feedback to where it needs to go. And we know where to find each other. When something happens to be not in my area of expertise, I have my internal network, a PM network that I navigate in order to make sure that it ends up at the right place, right? And so that works fairly well. It's really creating order to chaos when it comes to getting all of these inputs. And it's a practice by itself to streamline and structure that funnel or those funnels in such a way that it remains manageable. Thankfully, we have a much larger team. There's a handful of product PMs, but outside of that, we have what we call our customer engineering folks that also work on a daily basis on gathering and funneling feedback. We have everyone that is in the regional offices that are working with customers daily, and they have their methods. We have our direct channels with our community. You have the feedback button in the portal, which absolutely does reach us. And so there's ample opportunity to make yourself be heard. That's outside of Twitter, which I happen to be personally active on, but that's not a given for anyone on my team. It's fairly time consuming to combine that with your day-to-day. So not everybody has that appetite.
Yeah. And this is maybe a question for all you guys. When you look back at the history of the product, and it's gone from Windows Advanced Threat Protection through to being Microsoft ATP, finally Defender for Endpoint. Please don't change the name again. When you look back at that kind of history, what are the big game changers as far as making your lives easier? So, you know, Joe from a Dart perspective and Justin from an internal kind of operations perspective. I mean, when I look at it, I think of stuff like the unified client being a total game changer, you know. And there's a few other bits and pieces, like the recent improvements to tamper protection. They kind of jump out at me as being really cool stuff. Does anything kind of spring to mind for you guys, either as being stuff you're proud of getting into the product or really helping improve it?
Yeah, for me, it's parity. across the stack, across the operating systems from 20 toolbar 2 on up in client OS, you know, Windows 10 and 11, being able to have one conversation that mostly addresses all of those operating systems was a huge thing for me. Because, you know, when we're trying to deploy things in a hurry, it's like, okay, we got to have a few different conversations here because this product is this on this OS, this one does this, this isn't here, it's over here. So when Unified came out, that was like amazing. I mean, it was one of the coolest things because it simplified our conversations with the customer in a moment of chaos, really. And setting expectations was so much easier. It's like 2012 R2 on up is this. Anything older is going to be this. And it greatly simplified my life. It simplified the conversations. It simplified the configurations, the expectations. It was a game changer. I think that was probably the most beneficial for me lately, for sure.
Yeah, I would agree. I think from operations standpoint, the integration, it was like in writing the book, and I don't know if the guys agree or not. I don't think we talked about it, but it was like difficult not to scope creep because of MDE so integrated into M365 Defender. And then that for me encompasses so many other things, right? But from an ops perspective, it's just a pivot. You know, you need to pivot from the endpoint to the identity to, you know, your cloud access and what's going on there. And so that integration point has absolutely been like the biggest benefit in the way that we really leaned into it. I mean, internally, I mean, I'm more like borderline a customer, right, of these products. And mm-hmm. and internally, you know, those teams at times, especially in the past, felt pretty disparate. And you can see it just everybody coming together and really working toward making that unified portal like a consistent experience. I think I maybe shouldn't say anything because I don't know what's public and what's just us sometimes, but like MDI is coming in now and yeah. Being able to see all those alerts in there together with the MDE stuff has been great already. So, and the suppression logic getting tied together, right? So we can suppress things using the same kind of mechanisms and stuff has been really good.
Absolutely. And I guess, you know, talking about that integration, you know, you've even got, I think it was the last one to finally make its way there, though maybe Defender for Identity was, but you've also got Defender for Cloud Apps coming through there now, right? And you can just manage it all through that security.microsoft.com. It's a really sleek experience. Did mean I had to rewrite a ton of documentation, but hey, it's all good stuff. And so one of the other kind of things that's really pushing forward, and I just wonder how the clogs work internally when it comes to that, is, you know, you've got this whole security management for MDE now, right? Where a device doesn't have to be enrolled in Intune for you to manage it using the Intune admin center. What kind of, is that basically going to be the direction of the product, do you think? Because you can do it for Windows just now. I don't expect any spoilers or stuff, but can folks start to look to that to be, you know, are we going to see more centralization in the product?
Absolutely. So, I'll speak to that. And it shouldn't be a big surprise when you consider our unification story so far. Back in the day, MDE was kind of rapidly becoming the hub of all things endpoint security. You could plug third-party solutions in. You could plug other Microsoft security solutions in. It's really the birthplace of our XDR story to begin with. And so when you see kind of Defender for Endpoint expanding or Microsoft 365 Defender expanding, there's ample opportunity to make everything an integrated experience and also innovate on things like configuration management. Maybe we need to rethink there. Maybe we need to break through existing concepts and paradigms around manageability there when it comes specifically to endpoint security and the way how management affects your overall security posture and how we need to make sure that we facilitate taking control of that posture as opposed to like having to facilitate all of these different experiences across different products with different personas operating inside of an enterprise context. So that is very much a top of mind thing right now. And you'll see a lot of developments in that area coming throughout the foreseeable future. Yeah.
Neat. No, that sounds very exciting. I mean, you know, the whole centralization, it's part of, well, it's not just part of the Defender story, it's part of the whole Microsoft 365 story, right? Insofar as you can get away from all these different vendors, all these different portals and admin consoles.
Absolutely. And then I'll add to that, it's just also so, so important from a security perspective. The number one reason for customer compromise is misconfiguration still. And so that area is absolutely top of mind, combined with attackers liking to abuse our configuration. And so you mentioned tamper protection. That is definitely also a space that is top of mind when it comes to taking away the opportunity for attackers to use stuff against us, right? So that area will, that's a big investment area for Microsoft continuously. That is nowadays where the true cat and mouse game is being played.
Nice. Cool. Okay. One thing I wanted to kind of bounce off you guys and see if it was in the book, because again, I don't know how recently it was, but in the grand scheme of things, it's been quite recent, is the threat and vulnerability management aspect of Defender for Endpoint. I think, I mean, when I show customers, they're like, wow, you know, because in a lot of cases, they didn't have that with their previous antivirus platform, right? So this is kind of brand new to them. So, you know, used to be part of Defend for Endpoint called TVM, kind of got big enough where it became its own product, but it also falls under Defend for Endpoint, unless you exclude the add-ons, which just went generally available. Do you guys touch on any of that stuff in the book?
Yeah. Speaking of scope creep that Justin mentioned, there was a pivotal moment where we had to decide, do we go all in on TVM, or is this like a separate book? Is this a separate thing altogether? Correct me if I'm wrong, I think we talk about it, right? We talk about where it fits in, certainly what it does, what it can provide. But in terms of like going all in on it, I think will be something separate for another day. It's like you said, it's its own product. It needs its own platform to be spoken about. So I think we kind of left it at, here's how it fits in. Here's obviously what it does, what you can glean from it, from the portal. I don't think we went beyond that though.
Yeah, we placed the context around it, surely, because you can't ignore the benefits for the other areas that we cover on, such as deployment, updates, security posture management, throughout how this affects your security operations if you didn't have this practice in your environment, or what you can use from TVM that is relevant to these other areas, because it all ties together quite nicely. And so I do agree, when it comes to your customer conversation, you could have a separate session on TVM alone. You know, you could spend the whole day on it. And at that point also, the audience becomes slightly different, because now all of a sudden you're looking at more of a governance or security posture management function and or IT that is then directly responsible for maintaining that posture. And so that's where we really want to just empower the reader to be able to have that conversation on what it is, why it's important, as opposed to really diving into that area, because it's, pretty big. And I mean, it took us 8 months to get all of this together. I'm sure it would have taken us much longer if we tried to pull everything in scope. So yeah, that's one of the things that we're like, maybe we should write another book, or maybe not.
Every author says this is my last book until the next one, you know.
And it's, yeah.
The thing about vulnerability management, Defender vulnerability management, is, at least from my perspective of outside looking in, it's growing so fast. Maybe it's just because of all these new add-ons that we now get with it, but it's like every month I'm going on and I'm seeing new capability, right? So just getting your hands around all of that stuff while it's so rapidly moving to write a book, that sounds quite challenging to me.
And
it does bring me on to one of the things I definitely... Right.
Oh,
on you go.
No, I may have preempted your question there. It's like, how do you make sure that the book stays relevant for a period of time? Yes. Excellent point. And that's exactly right. And that's probably also why we steered away from TVM a little bit, because we also knew that was a rapid growth area that we couldn't possibly capture or do it justice, right? So that's where we really stuck to our principles and said, we need to make sure that we provide the context around the product that will remain relevant until, you know, the end of time, if can be.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is really acknowledging that that things are subject to change, but guess what? Here's this basic concept that explains how the product functions and why it functions in that way. So you understand why it's important for you. And if it goes by any other name, you will still find relevance in the fact that this is an area that you need to take care of, or the product is actually taking care of for you. And so, yeah, I'm not going to lie. There's been some hard calls. Being from product group, I knew stuff was going to come. So how do you either write about it or not? In the end, one of the things that we took as a rule of thumb is if it is in public preview, then we include it, period. If it's not, we'll leave it out. And it was a hard call. There's definitely some stuff that came out that I wish we had included. But then Joe was able to kind of grab the Zeek folks and grab some of that and put some of that in a book in last minute. And so we did try to grab, because we felt that was kind of a new big area for the product. So we wanted to be inclusive of that, at least give a sense of direction there. So that's kind of the sort of the compass that we use to navigate that challenge, right? Other areas of the book also think about troubleshooting, tips and tricks, deployment. We kind of touch on what are some of the most important aspects that remain relevant. And so that's where we might actually go a little bit more level 200 at times, just to make sure that we can broadly apply to this area. And then we pull you back in.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a large section of one chapter that's about, it's almost just generic project planning. It's, you know, here's how to plan a rollout to avoid impact. And it's focused around MDE, but the examples are universal, right? So yeah, it's really just like every bit of guidance Paul, you know, Joe and I could think of that we've seen value with over the years through, you know, enterprise work and working with customers and stuff like that. So.
Neat. Well, see, to me, that's so valuable. And that's kind of exactly what a book should be, right? Especially given the rate of the product changes. Because, I mean, I look back and one of the first IT books I ever got was called Mastering Windows Server 2008, I think it was, by Mark Manazzi. And it's like, I could still go back to that now if I had to go and deploy server 2019 or 2022 or wherever we're at now, and so much of it would still be accurate. And that's nothing to do with the rate of the product changes. It's just to do with the fact that it covers the fundamentals, and any of the little changes on the edges of that, well, the book's got me covered. And so that sounds to me like the kind of strategy that you guys have taken with this book. And it does bring me on to the kind of the next question that I wanted to ask is, insofar as, you know, tips and tricks, maybe things folks overlook when it comes to either deploying it or post-deployment when they're operational with it. What are some of the kind of little gold nuggets of advice that you could maybe give some folks?
So, before we launch into the details, let me just describe how we did that, because that might be of interest as well. Yep. Early on, during development of the book, I suggested we use little call-outs to impart these nuggets of wisdom or give that guidance. And that was agreed upon pretty quick. And then I had some inspiration being fairly new to the country here. I heard of something called cold snacks. Some YouTuber mentioned it, hey, it's time for a cold snack. And at the time, I thought, hey, he's alluding to a beer, like having a beer. And I was like, that's awesome. I'm going to keep that in. Actually, you know what? I'm going to use that for the book. So all of those little call outs, they're called cold snacks. And that was kind of throughout the book. And it's kind of a nice little hook. And it's also super relevant. And by the way, cold snacks, there is a beer called Montucky Cold Snacks. Turns out there's an actual beer called that. But I didn't know at the time, right? And so everything's called a cold snack. And the irony of it is that, especially for myself, I would say 80% of what I've written was at a bar or a brewery after work, beer in hand.
Nice. I just had to Google it because, you know, not being in the States either, I hadn't heard it called that. But yeah, cold snack, a 12-ounce can or bottle of beer. Good. So I'll be having some cold snacks after this show.
Yep. Definitely have some cold snacks. And then if I don't know if Justin or Joe wanna kind of mention some of the things that we put in the cold snacks. Because I don't wanna
There are so many. I mean, every chapter, we love the idea so much, and it kind of inspired us when we're thinking through something to go, oh, this is a cold snack. Let me separate that out. So they're highlighted in a different way so that they're easy to see. Nice. I think, funny enough, my favorite one that I put in there is not MD specific at all. I actually put in how I use Edge, the new Edge Chromium browser, and with the vertical tabs so that I can keep track of everything because everything's browser based now. And so I have all these portals open at the same time. And I said, I use this every day and I'm talking through how we do stuff in MDE. And I'm like, this is going to be really useful for people. So I threw that one in there too. But yeah, tons of product ones, but I don't have a good one offhand outside of that.
Well, I mean, there's definitely like Justin said, ones that are completely not related to MDE. And then there's ones where it's like, we're talking about, you know, we're deep diving on in a part of a product or, you know, talking about part of a product. And one of the cold snacks might be how maybe an initial implementation of said product caused all sorts of problems and, you know, kind of what that problem looked like internally, the costs of things. it's just funny. Sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's, you know, off topic, but valuable. And sometimes it's just an extension of a point we were trying to drive home.
Yeah. And sometimes it's kind of a nicer way of saying don't be an idiot.
I did have some notes from Paul at times that were like, be nice to the reader. let's reword this.
Yeah, let's.
If you're doing it this way, you might not be, you know, smart. And he's like, you can't say that because somebody's doing it that way for sure.
Depending on when the time of day we were writing, I think the tone probably reflected in some of that.
Yeah, you get grumpy when you're writing at night. Yeah, I remember getting called up because I was writing and I kept saying obviously, and I get a little tap on the shoulder saying, just because it's obvious to you doesn't mean it's obvious to the reader. And it's like, okay, that's fair enough. You know what I mean? Fair enough.
Well, that's exactly the sort of language I'm talking about. Yeah, it wasn't really harsh stuff. It was just like, this is unintentionally condescending, and we tried really hard. I think we're all, it can happen to all of us, and I think we just would
Some of it was plain hilarious because Joe would be on a gig for 72 hours and he'd get some writing in and I'd just reach out to him and say, Joe, what's going on, dude? Because it was just so extremely in your face going like, I don't think we can put this in the book, dude. I understand what you're trying to write here. Here's a different way I would do that. And then he'd be like, oh, yeah, I wrote all of that in 30 minutes after being pissed off from a gig after 72 hours. It's like, okay, I get it. It's fine.
Yeah.
I didn't have Justin and Paul over my shoulders, like, hey, man, I'll rewrite that for you. Justin, huge kudos to Justin for taking a lot of what I wrote and making it English. I think this is what you were trying to say. So I was like, yes, thank you.
Well, I think to that, you know, Paul did a great job of calling out like colloquialisms and stuff too, right? So speaking of like with cold snacks and how maybe that's international now. But there are a lot of things that I didn't realize I didn't realize wouldn't be interpreted in like Europe. They wouldn't understand what I was talking about, right? And so we tried really hard to make the book, you know, universally consumable.
Yeah, let's say Euro-friendly from my perspective. Like some of these things that Justin would have a turn of phrase and like, dude, I had never heard of that. That's so American. Let's find some different words for that. Yeah. To make it more accessible.
Yeah, we had, I mean, obviously with Paul and then some of our technical reviewers, I think is the term. We had people from around the world, you know, kind of giving us the perspective of making sure that this is universally understood. Because there's definitely some things that I wrote that weren't even just American. They were like deeply Midwestern. And like, yeah. What are you saying? Like, okay, can't word it that way.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Because I guess, you know, you're publishing the book through PAC Publishing. They're obviously, you know, I think they're maybe headquartered in England, but, you know, they've got folks over in India and stuff. So you've got that global team working with you, right? And I guess it's a good point because, again, it's something I've been guilty of. It's like, I'll just say a word and I'll get weird looks, and it turns out it's a Scottish word that isn't used anywhere else. And I'm just kind of like, oh, okay, fair enough. But I guess in a technical context, you have to be very precise with your language, right? Because you don't want to lead folks down that wrong path and they might misinterpret some of the stuff you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And the editors have been great, especially the copy editors. They just plain amazed me by the fact that they found every little thing that could be optimized, and they have like 100,000 little tweaks. And that is the piece that astonished me, is, you know, just get so much better. And then when you go like, oh, why all of these changes? First you resist, and then you go, okay, let me accept them all. And oh yeah, that does read a lot better. Like this is much more professional and much more structured. That said, there were certain terms where the editor was like, what does that mean? Can you spell it out? Or you need to define this acronym, or you need to explain what this is. And I just plain go, no, my readers are not idiots. They have prerequisite knowledge here. You know, I'm not going to go explain to anyone what a DMZ is. If they don't know, just go look it up. I mean, come on. The book is not that foundational. And so there's just certain things where we had some disagreements with the editors that really wanted to spell everything out. And I was like, okay, I'm going to make an author's decision not to treat my readers as if they were idiots. So it's kind of the opposite of what Justin was doing, where Justin was kind of going like, oh, yeah, that's obvious. I'm just assuming this. That the reader will understand, and but call that out. Like I assume, or this is obvious, and then we keep each other accountable and say, well, maybe it's not obvious to everyone. But this other thing was like, there's this definitely obvious thing. If you don't know what this is, then you know you probably should look for different work. Right? There's such a foundational thing. Like, what is DNS? Can you spell out DNS? And I was like, okay, let's not do that. Yeah, like, that's IP, not.
IP, yeah.
IP, yes, yes. IP.
Which I get it. You know,
wow.
That's their role. So it was great.
Oh, yeah. There's no blame on them. It's just funny. Like, where you'd stumble across that and go like, wait, what are you asking me to do? No. Oh.
Yeah.
It is profound to see, like, if you were to look at some of our early drafts versus, like, how we got the final PDFs, showing us how it prints. I mean, it's remarkable what they're capable of doing for us. So kudos to them.
Absolutely.
Neat. Yep. Good stuff.
I think maybe a good point there from what Paul was saying too, though, is like we regularly would call out like, this is not obvious to me. We need to spell this out more. And so just kind of back to where we started with you know, us coming from all these different directions to write the book, it really benefited from me going, Paul, I have no idea what this is. He's like, everybody knows what that is, but I didn't know, right? And so then I would take it on, or vice versa, and I would fill it in with what I needed to know at once he explained it to me, right? Like, here's what I mean. And then I could add all that context that I needed coming from zero to get it. And so hopefully most of the concepts are fleshed out fully enough that somebody coming from zero on that particular subject can pick it up. But also to that point, if there's any acronyms that are spelled out and you're like, why would you even spell this out? We were forced to.
Yeah.
So again, to maybe clarify, the target audience for this book. So you got to know what an IP address is. You got to know what DNS means. Other than that, someone that maybe is completely at the beginning of their Defender journey, maybe never deployed an AV before, this is the type of book that they can just pick up and run with.
Yes, but also if you have, but it's a competing solution, right? So there's various different possible entry points here. So the book is definitely relevant from the ground up. Although if you don't have the basic concepts of, you know, what is DNS, or, you know, what is an operating system, how do I update, and kind of those basics, then probably not for you. I think you'd need at least like a 100, 200 level sysadmin generic knowledge, talking about maybe CompTIA A+, right? If you're there, so that's not a high bar, but it does get, yeah, you know, it does get spicy at points. Like it does take you in depth. And so that's right, really why we chose the title for the book. It said, yeah, it's very accessible, it's very open, but at the same time, we will go deep at times. So if you're not following along, you're probably going to have to read it a couple of times to just really get to the, yeah, to the depth of it. And that's also why it is appealing for people that haven't worked with the product before, but have worked with competing products, that you are easily able to translate that. In fact, that's one of the foundational things for the book. Documentation doesn't help with that. If you don't know what something is called inside of the Defender suite, you won't find the right documentation for it. Like, for example, hey, I would like to perform task X because I did that in product Y previously, doesn't necessarily map fully to what you have in Defender. And so if you don't know the name of the feature that you're trying to configure, you won't get there. And so this book will help you get there. It'll help you understand, oh, so that's what this is. I know this from this other product. Similar, it will help me achieve the same goals. And now I get to read about it, and then I can go to documentation that's going to tell me how to actually deploy, or maybe some more details about implementation.
I think in the preface, maybe, I know there's some pages at the beginning of the book, where I think, where we outline kind of what Paul and Justin were alluding to, like,
yep,
these are some of the high level areas that you should have some experience in or some knowledge in to, yep, you know, give you some level of success reading this. So at least I'm pretty sure that's in there.
It's comforting to me that we had some really clever people review, because that tells me that this approach, which I feel is kind of risky, like how do you start at 100 and go 300 and sometimes 400 and then back to 100 and go back and forth? The literal feedback we had was, wow, this is in depth. It took me, you know, 2 attempts to read this chapter, but then I really got it and you nailed it. And that was halfway through the book when we got one of those feedbacks, and I was like, awesome. Mm-hmm. That was confirmation. Hey, I think we're doing the right thing. That said, hoping to get lots of feedback. And
yeah, you're kind of always anticipating feedback coming back saying, this is the worst thing I've ever read. Like, we're all just sitting there waiting for it.
Well, it's also about expectations. Like you set a tone, you give it a catchy title like In Depth. And then obviously that's super subjective. Like anyone like you, Ru, is going to read it, might go, oh, it's not too in-depth. That's based on your background, your knowledge, your experience. And then, yeah, maybe you're not getting full value out of the book if you're already super advanced in the product. But at the same time, and I think I mentioned this to you yesterday, I do think that even seasoned MDE veterans have ample opportunity to learn new things from this book.
I was just going to agree. Yeah, I think even the level 100 stuff, just to be fair, I don't know if any of us is arrogant enough to say that I can't read something that's level 100 that's a good idea that I've never seen before, right? And so we just tried to make sure everything was useful information. And so regardless of where you're at, I think, again, I think you're going to get something out of it.
Yeah,
for sure.
Nice.
There were tons of things at any level, 1, 2, 3, 4 level, that I was like, huh, I guess I just assumed it was this way, but I guess it's this way. Or you know, having access to him and some of the folks that Justin know, you can kind of go down the rabbit hole on a particular feature or a terminology or whatever, and just be like, I had this backwards. I had this sideways. I was kind of right on that. You know, it's just like, it filled in a lot of detail for me because it forced me to remove some of my assumptions. Just because I know this, I thought I knew that, but it's like, nope. If we're going to go into depth on both things, I had to create a lot of connections that I didn't otherwise have. So even though I thought maybe I was fairly seasoned or pretty seasoned, I picked up a ton, an absolute ton. And I'm sure if I read it again, I'd pick up more, just because I can't retain everything.
Yeah, Joe used it as reference material mid-writing. Like, he would use chapters on engagements as reference material. And then come back and go, we're lacking in this section because I just did an engagement and I needed to know this.
I did that a couple of times to you. I think Joe would ask me a question, hey, how does this work again? And I go, just read chapter 3, page something. And you go like, oh, yeah. I need to look it up. And he was like, oh, yeah, that's exactly what I needed. It's there. And that was good.
Gold. For me, Great. I mean, they're all gold.
Well, I mean,
I dive into a lot of what chapter 2 talks about. So,
I mean, if you guys are still learning stuff from the process of the book, then I think that means even your most kind of seasoned MDE person is going to get some value from it. And look, the thing is, it's like, I look at it and I think two things. Because I know that a lot of the folks that will be viewing this, they're in their little MDE online bubble where all we do is talk about Defender and everyone thinks we're crazy. But, you know, I think we'll get two main pieces of value out of it. And the main thing that comes to mind really is, even if it's stuff that we already know, one, it's a different perspective on it, maybe just a different way of articulating it so that when for having conversations with customers, it might make it a bit easier to explain it. But then two, also just that, what would you say, that reassurance that, yes, this is the right way, you have understood it properly, right? And there's no dubiety by having that reference book that's gone through, you know, the technical reviews and the peer reviews and all that. It's like, okay, no, you are doing it right. Because I think that's something that, in my experience anyway, and this is across everything to do with 365, sometimes customers just wonder, I've done it, have I done it right? Can I get a sense check on this? So I guess even if you've done the MDE deployment, the book's still going to be worth getting to kind of check your homework, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I'll give you more than that. We have kind of a post-deployment section, like, to talk about like continuous security posture management, which remains relevant. And then we also have troubleshooting and references. So if you are in operation, but you encounter a situation that you don't understand, troubleshooting section will be a good guide. And then we have put, we could have put probably twice the content in the last chapter, which is a reference chapter. But there, for example, we just simply describe every single setting that you see when you type get MP preference. We describe it in our own words and tell you what it is in sort of natural language. And that's not in documentation. So that will, nice. I mean, when you encounter that in the wild and you go like, wait, what is that? You can actually go and look it up.
Yeah. That was one of my favorite things, by the way, that Paul did that. I'm a nut for those details.
Yeah. Right?
I want to know, if I run a command like get MP preference, I want to know what every single thing in there just out of spite. I want to know.
And some of them weren't documented at all. I mean, there were maybe internal docs or something like that. I think there were likely things we shouldn't put in there that
maybe
we
did,
but
if you need more staff to cover the Americas, I might be available soon.
You'll be good.
Undocumented stuff, I think we tried to steer away from that, and it's mostly my compass that I applied to that, because, you know, I had to sometimes actually check with Justin and Joe, say, hey, can you look at a production tenant, because I'm not sure that we actually released this yet or that this is actually in a preview or known. And then sometimes they go like, yeah, I don't see that. What are you talking about? I have no idea what that is. And then sometimes, indeed, even with get MP preference, I'd run that on my own Microsoft internal box. And then you would see stuff that is just in very early dog food stages. So you can't write about that. There's no guarantee that that's even going to go live at some point in time. So that was a little bit of complexity. And sometimes what we have in docs is a one-liner description that means absolutely nothing to anyone, right? It's just so generic that it doesn't make sense. And that's where try to add more context to even those, to every setting. I think that was kind of the the most annoying piece for me was that I'd copy these tables from our docs and then I'd elaborate on them. And then they would get flagged by their content inspection system saying, hey, you're committing plagiarism because you pulled this off the internet and it's exactly the same. And no, it's not. I was like, it's not. Or even worse, I had created this, I had copied this table and then it got flagged. And then the copy editor or the editor said, hey, can you please put this in your own words? And then I'd write back, these are my own words. I wrote this for the public doc. What do you want me to do? I ended up rewording it just to avoid that. And I mean, I understand, but at the same time, it was stupid. It was,
Well, no, look, that's good because that kind of tells me as well that even through the writing process, you're still giving some of that stuff away for free, right? And it's updated in documentation. So that's very cool because, you know, I'll be honest, just speaking plainly, there's been a ton of improvements over the Defender for Endpoint documentation over the last year to 18 months, right? And I look at some of the improvements with regards to ASR documentation and exclusion documentation, stuff like that has just come on leaps and bounds. And I've even, tell you what, the other thing I've just done is, in the background there, I ran get MP preference, and there's so much stuff in there, I'm like, that is a big project, just translating that to plain English. So well done for that. Enable file hash computation. That's the one. That was the first one for me that when I seen that, I was like, this isn't documented anywhere. That was always an interesting one.
Yeah, thank you. I think there was a thread on Twitter with you.
Yeah.
And maybe it was you as well, Rue.
I remember. Yeah, there was this one.
Probably, yeah.
That was kind of an inspirational moment as well, because I tried to put it all in one tweet. So I tried to explain it within the constraints of 140 characters. And that it forced me to the extreme to make it as clear and concise in as few words as I could. I think I managed, but at the same time, yeah, that's one of those things where it's clear that some of these more abstract concepts are just very difficult to explain.
Yep. Great. Awesome. Kind of also brings me on to something I was wondering, like, because when I'm thinking about how in-depth you can go about a product like Defender for Endpoint, in the back of my mind, I'm kind of thinking there must be points at which you're like, okay, let's put the foot on the brake here because we don't want to make red teamers or the bad guys' lives too easy. You know, there must be a limit on exactly how much we can tell about this product works. So how did you strike that balance between, you know, just giving away too much?
Yeah, I this was a struggle. And particularly, essentially the guideline there is, we're not writing anything that you can go and find out by yourself. That was kind of, if you can observe it or measure it, or if you can run a trace or a procmon, if there's a reasonable way for you to find it out, it's not a secret. And so that was kind of the high level rule of thumb where we were like, okay, if you can figure it out by yourself with some skills, then it's not a secret, right? There's people out there that are much more in depth and they publish their secret information, and then we have to deal with that anyway. So we didn't go to that level. We didn't write these articles where we tear the product apart and say, hey, this process, you know, it stops and then there's a window of opportunity. There's none of that there, right? It's not the type of internals that we went to, not the type you would find as a security researcher. And I think at the end of the day, that's probably good enough. And also, if we were to go down that rabbit hole, we'd probably need another book just for that.
We definitely moved the line for those types of things. There was only a few opportunities or a few moments where we had to kind of double check, like, is this oversharing, you know, with some graphs or flow charts that we wanted to put in there, you know, can't give away too much secret sauce about how the product does certain things. But I still think we have enough detail in there where people are like, oh, this is really cool to see how the communication actually works and how it does checks. And so, yeah,
We did have the luxury of being able to just ask internally, go like, are you okay with this? I'd ask one of our architects and say, hey, you know, I want to put this in the book. What do you think? And they'd go like, yeah, sure.
Yep.
And they'd give me the rationale. For example, this is something that someone with 2 minutes of time could figure out. Just run a proc model and you'll see it and stuff like that. And they're like, okay, sure, fair enough. I mean, a lot of it actually, if you look at process activity, if you're trying to dive into how the product functions, just look at the timeline in MDE, right? You can literally see what the product is doing. Good. Little secrets there,
Yeah, if you look at the mention, honorable mentions or whatever it ends up being titled, there's a long, long, long list of people in there that were incredible in terms of helping out and helping us understand things. Kudos to a lot of people.
Yeah, they're mentioned by name. We spend a lot of time. I spend a lot of time interviewing people one-on-one. Key figures inside of Microsoft that have been, for example, have been with the product since 1998. And just having access to those people, letting them tell their story, trying to synthesize that. There were some pieces in there where I'm like, oh, that's kind of, isn't that a secret? And then they're like, no, it's no longer in product. And I'm like, all right, you know, sure. If I had to do it again, I would have maybe spent more time on history just because it's so interesting. As it stands, it was a lot of work just getting that history, right? With all of the interviews, it's actually, you know, a very intensive piece of work. And then you write it down in a concise way and it turns out, oh, you only have 1.5 pages that tell a 10-year story. And they're like, okay, I could do so much more. And Joe's experience, we're on campus today. And so we've been meeting up with a bunch of people. There's absolute legends here that have, you know, they created WinPE or, you know, the Dart tool, not talking about Joe's Dart, but the disaster and recovery toolkit. Right. And you'd have a conversation with those people. And it turns out there's a relationship with Defender and, you know, and then you're like, oh, that should have been in the book. But yeah who has the time? Then, so
it goes from like a technical book to like a journalist, like investigative historical piece. Right. Paul did a great job. The lead in is that history that kind of sets the stage. And then we go into the product itself.
We've unfortunately left a lot of spin-off options for ourselves, despite none of us wanting to write one or two books. There's just history shows that there might be a third or fourth.
I'm still a hard no now. We'll see.
Nice. You know, the history is definitely probably the part I'm looking forward to most, because, you know, have you guys ever read Shell of an Idea by Don Jones? And it's the history of PowerShell. And it's talking about, you know, all the way back from Jeffrey Snover, the conception of the idea, selling it to the business, the development of it. And it's just so interesting, you know, how these products, they form people's lives and careers, and then they're used by millions of people, right? And it's just so cool finding out all the way going back to their kind of embryonic stages. I was going to ask you more stuff about the history of it, but I'm going to make folks buy the book in order to find out about it.
They can get a sample. Okay. If you go to Amazon right now, they actually show you the first, 5 pages or something like that. So they can actually get the history up until like 2010 or something. So.
Right. Cool. So you want to find the rest of it, you got to buy it. Excellent. Good stuff. So I guess we better wrap up here. So just to confirm, in the show notes for the episode, I will put links to Amazon UK, Amazon US, all that good stuff. Is that the best place for folks to buy it, is Amazon, or should they be looking elsewhere?
Great question. I mean, if you're in a country that Amazon serves well, as in, you know, you're happy with Amazon and stuff like that, sure. They're probably the top of mind option, but the book is on so many platforms. If you look for the ISBN, you'll actually find many, many outlets. Barnes & Noble is one of the ones that we had early on for pre-order as well. You can get it on Kobo for your e-reader.
Cool. PAC as well.
You can, yeah, you should be able to go to the PAC website as well. I don't think it's up there yet. Yeah, we couldn't find it yet, but yeah, so that's kind of the advice. When I looked for the book by ISBN, I actually found a lot of resellers as well. So if you're in some remote area that Amazon doesn't serve, then you're probably going to be able to find it just by Googling for or Binging for the ISBN.
Awesome. Good stuff. Right. That's awesome. We'll definitely, we'll share all the links I can find on Google. Mm-hmm. I'll put in the show notes so that folks can grab a copy. So just before we wrap up, if folks want to find you guys online, follow you on Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever you guys do, where should they reach you out?
Yeah, I mean, by name on LinkedIn, Joe Anich, and then Twitter is TRK_RDY. Gearhead, track ready.
Yeah, I think we actually have those in our, somewhere in our author bios or in the book. Thought we had them. I think we may have them somewhere, but yeah, LinkedIn by name, and then I'm at Threadsman on Twitter.
Yeah, and same. I think I'm probably most active on LinkedIn, but then I'm also on Twitter as at JustGravy, JustGravy. But Paul's the main tweeter in the group, him and Joe, so they mostly just tag me in stuff they tweet. So. But yeah. Yeah, hit me up on LinkedIn, nice. Private message me if you ever want to chat. I'm happy to mentor folks too. So,
awesome. Jeez. Mentored by internal Microsoft SOC. There's an opportunity you can't turn down. Okay, that was awesome, guys. Anyone listening, I know folks will be going out to buy the book on the back of this because I'm probably going to order a few more copies to give out to people just based on some of the stuff you've said in it. So that's great. Thanks for joining us on the show, folks. Remember, everyone, buy a copy of the book. Also subscribe to the channel because it helps us out a ton. And we will catch everyone in the next show. Cheers, folks.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Rue.
Thanks, Rue.